All right, my name is Chris Bell, and today's date is the 22nd of June, 1984. I'm speaking with Colonel Carson of his home, and this is our fifth interview. And the last day, we got past VE Day, and you were in Holland, and we discussed quite a bit of your duty with the occupation force. And I think you were going to finish that off and tell me about what the Army told you to do, because we ended off by talking about you being a regular officer, and that you would go where they told you to go. Where, in fact, did they tell you to go?
Yes. Well, they told me to go to the occupation force. I was rather incensed at the beginning of the war to have to volunteer to go overseas as a regular officer. That's what I thought I had to do anyway. Mm-hmm. And then I was incensed at the end of the war again when they wanted me to volunteer all over again to go to the Pacific or the occupation force or what. So I sort of reneged and didn't volunteer for anything, saying you can send me where you want. Finally, when I was sent to the occupation force, the usual piece of paper followed me and said, now would you like to volunteer for the occupation force? I said, no, I'm quite content to stay here. But I'm damned if I'm signing another bloody piece of paper. So
you,
I didn't.
You would have been assigned to the occupation force and they wanted you to volunteer for the
occupation force. So I guess I became a conscientious objector, not to in service, but to the paper war that they were trying to do. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I served very happily in the occupation force. I said, if you want me to volunteer for something, I'll volunteer to go home. But that obviously isn't sensible. You don't want that kind of volunteering. So anyway, that was a slight brush with medium senior officers who didn't think I was being very sensible, and perhaps I wasn't. But what, that doesn't seem to matter to me. It seemed a silly thing to be pursuing. However, the occupation force was really, I would think, a normal thing for a regular officer to have to go and attend or be assigned to.
You sort of expected
that. And I didn't object to it, really. Mm-hmm. Anyway, about two-thirds of the way through the occupation force, they suddenly sent over a lot of the people that had been in Canada and hadn't been out, including the ones that had ex-zombies, you know, the ones that wouldn't volunteer. Mm-hmm. And then they did volunteer later on, and some of them were older ones that would never be sent over anyway. Mm-hmm. Some of them were ones that were just came through college just about the right time and joined. They weren't really objecting to war or anything of that sort, but they were somehow missed out and were sent over. I don't remember whether they were nominally ones that had objected to go to war or not, but some of them were classified that way by people overseas when they arrived. Mm-hmm. And it was rather silly because they were quite good fellows. They were quite decent people. We rather assumed that they didn't want to come and they got sent over, and that, there's some truth in that.
A lot of them, I guess, were conscription.
Yeah, I guess they were. They got into the conscription side of things. But funny enough, when the occupation force closed, they were the hardest guys to get to go home. They didn't want to go home. They were having a ball over there. So, anyway, it was...
Was there any friction between the people who had actually served in France and Holland and Germany to those who were coming over now?
A little bit, but not much. You'd kind of, the odd rude remark would pass, but it really wasn't very serious. Mm-hmm. Usually they were sort of snide remarks, I guess, and sometimes very, very unfortunate because they weren't justified. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, some individual who'd done a perfectly good wartime job in Canada, because that's what he's best suited to, was classified as a zombie or as an objector. And he wasn't. He was one who was in some frozen employment. Mm-hmm. And the sad part, right after the war, when the veterans' preference was given to employment in defense activity, particularly in civil service sort of appointments, a few quite worthy individuals who'd served all the time in Canada were classified just the same as if they had been conscripts. Yeah. And they weren't. And that was usually only because of their age or stage or basic education or ability. Mm-hmm. I remember one very good sergeant major who was been maintaining Wainwright Camp the whole bloody war, and when we tried to get a civilian to take the job somewhat the same as he'd been doing all the time, we put his name up and rather wanted him because he knew what everything was about and was very efficient. And he was turned down because he didn't have veterans preference. Hell, he'd been in the war the whole war. He was 45 or when the war broke out, so he obviously wasn't going to do very much overseas, except in the same capacity in England. Perhaps he wouldn't have gone to France at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very unfair assessment of a perfectly good individual. So I became very opposed to these preferential treatments for overseas people, although I was basically part of the overseas people.
Could you understand the necessity or the reasoning behind
it? No, I couldn't. It was pure preference. Largely through things like the Legion, to classify some of these people as not quite as nice as us.
And it's an elitism taking a form.
It's an elitist sort of form, yeah. And that same goes on now, and I don't approve it very much at all. I don't like it. That's one of the reasons I don't like politics. The same thing goes on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm uncomfortable in these pressure people. They don't interest me very much.
Well, tell me what.
I mix with them quite often.
Well, you more or less have to if you reach a certain level.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, tell me, what would you have done to replace that sort of preferential treatment? Would you have done what the Americans say did with the GI Bills, as opposed to, in terms of educating people to a higher level and giving them that sort of?
We in fact did do that.
Mm-hmm.
The there were quite a lot of there was the Carkey College was in fact Canadian, not American to start with, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The Legion organized a courses which were built around the self study sort of thing, and they were basically education courses to upgrade your standard of education from, let's say, grade 8 to 9 to 10, that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhat similar ones were run by various units, very often using the Legion courses, correspondence courses.
Mm-hmm.
And in London, I think it was in London, in England anyway, they had this Carkey College, or the Canadian college to in fact keep people busy, and this was very active during the occupation force and in the stage of just before they get everybody starting to go home. It started quite a long time before that. I don't know exactly when it started, because I wasn't familiar with it, but I do remember it was quite easy to get people enrolled and to upgrade them academically for future development. Now, for instance, it was probably help people get into a university that they wouldn't otherwise have been able to get into.
Mm-hmm.
The universities lowered some of their entrance standards and had a lot of equivalents that they ran and took in an awful lot of veterans. And I'm not sure they said they had to be overseas veterans, but veterans anyway.
Mm-hmm. Are you against that idea as well?
No, I'm all for it.
But that's still preference, though.
Well, sure. But they took them in because they had missed the opportunity in a 4 or 5 year period of their lives when they normally would be going to university or going through the final stages of high school to get into university.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very successful because most of the universities acknowledged that the standards of behavior and the standards of academic accomplishment far surpassed what it had been before, because they didn't have young fellows just goofing off and being sent because they're going there because their parents wanted them to go to it. They had learned
individuals.
The desire, the necessity of getting ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, a lot of community colleges now with their re-education or their second start. Somebody's been out on a trade, if that isn't quite as glamorous as they thought, goes back and tries to do something else. And I think that's a very good way to get our populace better trained.
Mm-hmm.
Now that there's no military sort of payoff, certainly it should be a purely competitive business for the individual who's got enough gumption to do it.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few advantages, because you could transfer your veterans' allowance into a university course, and that was good. It was a really quite a good settlement thing. I knew the individual that had written the basis for this. In fact, it was his thesis. He was doing his PhD at Queen's. His name was Bill Agnew, and he joined the He was on the Queen's staff, and he joined the COTC, the outbreak of war, and he stayed with it for a while. And then, when he was a little too old, he joined the military government finally. But he wrote, as his PhD thesis, The Soldier's Resettlement, based on the First War and a lot of other countries as well.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, they used that as the guide for the thing. And ergo, he didn't get his PhD because the thing had already been published for another purpose. He considered, and with good grace, that this was his war effort to contribute this to the Department of Veterans Affairs.
But he didn't get
any acknowledgement for it at all.
That's very short-sighted.
He did get a job finally in the Department of Immigration as a citizenship in the citizenship branch, and he did a very good job in that. But Bill Agnew should have been a PhD. He wasn't. He got his master's and employed as such. PhDs weren't quite as important after the war,
mm-hmm.
or during the war, as they are now. But I always thought the poor guy, his war effort was not only teaching to start with, and then later on in government service, on military government. He went overseas as part of the military government. He was a very good historian, and he had used this as his sort of his main thesis. Why he chose that, I don't know, but they used it, and that meant that he couldn't use it as his thesis.
I got
I'm not sure they even asked him if they could use it before they borrowed it from the Queen's University Library.
Mm-hmm. And before he had a chance to submit it as his thesis.
Yeah.
That's dreadful.
Well, he always took a very, a very national thing. He figured this was his contribution to help the system.
Well, I can understand it because I've looked at what happened after the First War, and it was a great shambles. I mean,
yeah.
Nothing was really known how to do it. And it was all done on an ad hoc sort of basis.
Well, his W.H. Agnew, you may find in somewhere around some of his theses, but it was the basis of the resettlement thing that the Department of Veterans Affairs put through.
Is he still alive?
No, he's dead years ago. His widow is still alive.
So you were how long with the occupation force in Holland?
Till it closed. better look up the date. I went to the working for Colonel Wilkins, and he was the CRE Works in the occupation force, and I was the deputy CRE Works, or his deputy. We went there in June 45. And I returned to the United Kingdom in April of 46, or just a year, not quite a year. And then came back to Canada in June 46, so it was about a year of the occupation force and all the fiddling around getting back.
When you left, were you one of the last Canadian units to leave Europe? Because there wasn't an occupation force or even a contingent as we had with NATO and have with NATO. There weren't any Canadian forces after you.
Oh, no. It was only about a year after this they sent troops back overseas again. But they there was a division, 3rd Division, commanded by General Vokes, and a regular infantry division with three brigades and three field squadrons and a field park squadron.
No armor?
And then, pardon?
No armor at all?
I think there was an armored regiment with it, yes. I've forgotten the exact makeup of it, but it's in lots of the histories. It's pretty straightforward. But in addition to that, this small organization, and we can't have been more than about 150 people, were organized, which was called CRE Works. And CRE Works had the headquarters in Oldenburg, which was very close to the divisional headquarters, and we worked in the Canadian area for 30 British Corps. It was the occupation organization. We were part of the 30 British Corps. And we had some responsibilities outside the Canadian division area, for instance, in Osnabrück, which was a 30 Corps area. But most of it was within the Canadian division area. We had three sections, one in Wilhelmshaven, one in Osnabrück, and one in York. Up in the Weser. And we Canadians thought we were working with the British, and the British thought we were working with the Canadians. We got away with murder a few times. We had we requisitioned cars and automobiles for our transport. We didn't have any. We weren't a regular unit at all. We didn't have any DND stuff other than our equipment, our rifles and that sort of stuff. We weren't very militant. We used to borrow with it anything. We very often used prisoners of war for some works, particularly in two airfields that we had. One was to build big accommodation on it, and the other one was to reconstruct the thing as a sort of administrative center. Mm-hmm. And we would have a company of infantry guard these guys. I remember one time, as you perhaps may or may not know, the German, God, there must have been army, must have been at least, oh gosh, there must have been 170,000 of them up north of the peninsula between Wilhelmshaven, and there's a canal, I think it's the Wilhelmshaven Canal, but there's a canal that goes pretty well right across that peninsula, and they had to stay north of that. Mm-hmm. It wasn't very well guarded, but it was patrolled by largely scout cars and the armored people, the
infantry as well. Are you saying a German unit intact?
But disarmed. No arms, though.
So they weren't in prisoner of war camps?
Nope. They were just in district, living entirely on their own, and we just kept them up there. But we would get a battalion of German engineers to go to work, and we'd have a Canadian infantry company to guard them. And one time, at the rendezvous, right on the sapper, a sergeant on a motorcycle was there, and the infantry company didn't turn up. So the full colonel, who was in charge, said, "Oh, we'll guard ourselves." So about 75 miles through this occupied area, this German column of about 1,200 people, all sorts of trucks, German trucks, not ours,
of course in German,
led by one Canadian sergeant, went wheeling down, and they all arrived. And there wasn't any problem. The infantry were pretty upset, and they took them back again, but we didn't lose any, as far as we know. And we had some of them in smaller groups, and we found one of our subunits was giving some of these soldiers weekend passes. What a hell of a stink. The provost came to me and said, "Did you know that Major Smalling is giving weekend passes to these guys?" I said, "No, but it's rather a good idea." "What's your point?" I said, "Well, God, you can't do that. These are prisoners of war." And I said, "Have we lost any?" He said, "No." Well, I said, "Bugger off until we do." We do. Now, I suppose we would probably have beaten someone in the head and thrown them in the bag, too, to make up the numbers, but we didn't lose any. What really would happen, some of these characters who've been assigned to these outside jobs, outside of the area the north of that canal, mm-hmm. And would stay there, were pretty worried about where their families were. And as I say, Bob Smalling gave them a weekend, one or two of them weekend passes to go and find their families, and back they'd come. Probably they'd take a good deal of food along with them, and they were hungry enough, then we knew damn well they're coming back.
Mm-hmm. Well, I dare say that where they were, I mean, they had more freedom. They had food, at least. If they went back to Germany proper, it could be in Russian hands.
That's right. Well, that was the thing. Some of them were close to the Russians. They didn't know where their families were, and they'd go and try and find out that they were all right, come back happy. Mm-hmm. So we didn't really have... We had a very good relationship with the German troops. They were well organized.
Were they troops or German engineers?
German engineer troops. Well, no, some of them are not, but most of them are engineers, yeah.
Were they of equal quality to ours?
Yeah, very much so.
Did they have their own equipment and whatnot?
Yes and no. We had about 1,000 pieces of road repair equipment, like road rollers and dump trucks and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Not quite as sophisticated as we had. They didn't have bulldozers as such. They had a lot of scrapers, but not bulldozers. Mm-hmm. We would allocate these things to them. They would come just in just ordinary trucks with their own native ability, no tools at all. We would give them tools for the job, leave the tools on the job. And for that, we always had a certain number of infantry around to do the policing. These work sections I think there were five officers and 37 other ranks, that sort of thing. There were only four of those and one headquarters, and we had 1,000 people, 1,000 pieces of road repair machinery.
It was simply yours?
We gathered it together in a dump. Most of it was German and municipal equipment and that sort of stuff. We just gathered everything that was any use for roads together.
Where was it to be used by your unit solely, but not by the British units?
Well, no, we did play with the British occasionally because we had part of our thing in the British areas, but the British, we've loaned some to them. I remember when the occupation force closed, we were short a road roller. And there was a hell of a stink. They weren't going to let me leave because Ron Wickles had left and I became the acting CRE. And anyway, they were just about to stop me from going even leaving Germany. I said, look, I'm not going to steal a road roller. And if I did, where in the hell would it be?
You could send it back piece by piece, probably.
Probably. So they admitted that maybe it's just a paper mistake. God knows that thing. You know, there was a great story about some Canadian who picked up an engine, a railway engine, and drove it to Paris. Mm-hmm. And they were obviously train engineer, mm-hmm. And got parked it in the Gare du Nord or one of the and came back after the weekend, picked up the engine and back to near their unit again. Magnificent stories of that sort of thing.
Canadians can be rather ingenious, can't they?
Yes, yes.
Especially the other ranks.
Oh yes, yes.
When it comes to sorties like that.
Well, the officers were occasionally you get an officer doing these sort of things, but most often it was another rank.
Well, officers had to be accountable. I mean, they were responsible for the machinery and for the
They were. We had a very large dump of all these small machinery things like generators and pumps and that sort of stuff. A huge dump. And I had somebody come to me one day and wanted me to let him have a couple of these things. He'd take them into Brussels or someplace, they sort of flog them and bring back all sorts of goodies. I said, no, you can go to hell. These are engineer things. If you want to play around with rations, that's not our purview. Go ahead and play with rations. And I don't care what you do with flogging rations, but you're not flogging any of these pieces of machinery that we've collected and are in. Anyway, so it's a bit of a warped sense of responsibility, except that for instance, it was always very easy to take your ration in flour instead of bread, take it down to a German bakery, and they bake you the most magnificent bread. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, usually with a caraway seed in it, but because they like caraway seed. But we tried to make sure nobody played around with our equipment, because we might abuse somebody else's type of things like petrol or gasoline or rations, but not engineer equipment.
Were they pretty sticky? I'm thinking of the higher authorities as to who was responsible for what.
No, they really didn't have much of a control over it. I think probably nobody except we ourselves knew what we had in our what we call our engineer dump.
Mm-hmm. And would you take strict inventories or make strict inventories?
As close as you could, yes. But of course, if you're going to be in use, you had to let it go out for use. It was there's a terrible tendency by people who run stores to hold a thing and not use it, then you don't lose it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you send it out for use, then you might lose it, and you might have some problem. But and indeed you do. But the purpose of the thing was for general use of restoring the whole damn area.
Mm-hmm.
We I'm trying to think of the phrase. We had a Major Lovett Fraser in Osnabrück, and that was in the British area. He started a factory making nails, and another one making glass. He didn't have any authority to do it, and there was an awful stink because these were both wartime reparations factories. You know, they would be making some sort of guns or whatever. But they knew how to make nails and make glass. And at one stage, we had the only bloody glass manufacturing thing in Germany. And I think most other people tried to get it stopped because they were damn well jealous. We were putting glass back in some of these buildings. Nobody else had any.
Did you find that the attitude amongst Canadians was, let's not do anything that we're not told to do because we take, you know, we take a bit of initiative? We
certainly not in the works area. That was one of the really delightful things. The initiative was really great, to the extent of getting crapped on for being too initiative. And this guy Fraser Harris, it was the British chief engineer, who was a bit of a worrywart, came to visit him, and he told him, let down his hair, and told him all the things he had done illegally, for which all the poor old general could say was, yes, you had been naughty, haven't you, but it has been useful. He just manipulated him beautifully. And this was this glass factory, because they were pretty upset. The Brits didn't see why the hell the Canadians should have all the glass in Germany. But it was spread fun away, because the people in the 34 headquarters, I'm talking about the engineers, thought we were being adequately controlled by the Canadians, and the Canadians thought we were being adequately controlled by the British, and neither were really giving us any guidance at all. Mm-hmm. So we would open roads and build bridges that nobody bothered to tell us we should do. These were just redo basic highways and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Using the German for it, we were not paying, it wasn't coming out of Canadian money, it was coming out of German reparations money. And I suppose the military government people had a hell of a time trying to untangle how much all this cost.
Would you fill out the necessary forms and send them in and say we're doing this and this?
There weren't any forms. There really weren't any forms at all.
Nothing at all?
No, we would say, bridge is such and such, rebuilt. We had forms for requisitioning of material, mm-hmm. And if we wanted it, let's say that there was a generator in such a place, we wanted it, and partly because we might need it, or a dozer, or not dozer, a dump truck, we would just issue a requisition form, and then that was a proof to the owner that it had gone to this purpose, and the military government had to sort it out. I guess it took them years to sort all that crap.
Well, certainly a requisition form has to go to higher authority first and then to the...
No, we just gave it to the individual and then sent the copy through channels. It took months to get the proper channels.
Sounds like a very quick way to end one's career. I mean, on the paper pushers were in Ottawa.
It would, but if Ottawa had anything to do with it, you're quite right, it would have. But thank God we were in the British core area, mm-hmm. And they have a much more prosaic way of looking at these sorts of things. No, I remember... One time, they tried to ration petrol, oil, and gas, POL. And we had, as I say, 1,000 pieces of road-making machinery, so we needed a hell of a lot of gas. And on Wednesday morning, I phoned the controller in the Canadian Division Headquarters, Red Parody, and said, Red, come on down, we're having a party for the rest of the week. What the hell's going on down there? Well, you guys have cut off all the gas, and we can't do any work unless we have to have gasoline, because everything runs around gas around here. So we might as well party. We've got lots of champagne. Anyway, he said, oh God, you bastard. So he signed for some more gasoline. And the only way you could do it, there was no way you could say that because we have had over the last 16 weeks, and we hadn't been formed 16 weeks. We only started this business of repairing roads, so we'll say, 3 or 4 weeks before that, so we didn't know how much gas. There was no forecast. So they would take a unit our size and think, count the number of vehicles we had, and forget that we had 1,000 kinds of road rollers and trucks, dump trucks and stake trucks and that sort of stuff. And 1,000 Germans driving them, too. Anyway, and most of those were civilian, although some of them were military.
Some of the drivers, the German drivers.
Mm. We, in effect, took over all the public works that we could find of all the municipalities in our area.
Mm-hmm. Was there any structure to the civilian groups?
Yeah, if each city, municipality, we'd take their engineering department right over, mm-hmm. and take all their drivers and all their maintenance people and put them under our orders.
Mm-hmm.
You'd use as many of their supervisors as you possibly could, yeah, of course. And that many people, you had to have a lot of German. And we couldn't speak German, so how could you give them orders? No, it was really just a matter of running them. They hadn't have any source of supply for anything, so if you didn't run them, get some gasoline, give them some direction to what's going to be cleaned up.
But there were sufficient Germans, trained Germans, within the towns and cities to do this kind of work? Because I'm thinking that the young people who would do the physical work would be in the army or in prison of war camps at this time.
That's right. But you see, most of them had yeah, I guess that's true. We did have to augment it though with some of the ex-military people, or sometimes prisoners of war, and give them some of the vehicles. When we went into one of the two airfields, for example, there was really no civil works organization handling that. There were a few of the old maintenance people around the place, yes, but if we want to do a project, build a building or make a new strip or whatever it might be, we really had to import everything. So that's when we'd use prisoners of war, using some of the equipment we had gathered together. Now that the equipment mostly was right on in situ in the various towns.
What about the Germans themselves, the soldiers? How did they? I suppose that they were glad the war was over and they're happy they're going to be alive and all that. But did they work with you willingly without any reservation?
Yeah, because we were just rebuilding their own country.
And they understood this.
Yeah, I think so. We didn't even have any trouble with them if we were doing things like developing officers' messes and that sort of stuff. In fact, they were quite intrigued. They were partly because they were getting fed, and partly because they were employed and were going to be treated reasonably well.
Can
I think they liked the Canadian area, the Canadian people. Canadians were not rough on them. By and large.
Canadians tend not to be quite as arrogant as, say, the British are in the dealings with people.
No, that's true.
Can I ask you this? Were there any examples or instances of a sort of sabotage by underground German units? Or, you know, there was always this big to-do about these wolf flayer groups, or I forget the titles of them, but youth people.
Right at the end of the war, there was a little bit, but not much. I've forgotten the name of the town, south of Osnabrück. That there was some sniping, and they killed the CO of one of the Canadian units and a few other people, and the general burned the whole damn town down. Well, our general, to make sure that they realize they can't get away with this nonsense. I don't remember, I wasn't there. We were nearby, and we did make use of the stuff, because it the town with everything burned down was magnificent road making material. With all the wood was burned out. quite a lot of their buildings are stone or brick really, and the window frames and that sort of stuff are all wood. If you knock them down with explosives, you got an awful lot of wood mixed up in it, and the plaster inside. But if it was burned, plaster would be there, but most of the wood had been burned out, or at least most of it gone. So it was a good way of giving us some material, but it wasn't a... There may have been others. I think there were a few, but not very serious.
Do you know, I've never heard of this having taken place, but did it lead to any political repercussions afterwards? Did the Germans ask for...
No.
Nothing at all?
Not that I know of. May have, but you see, this isn't the thing that I would have heard about. I went back to work to something else entirely,
I suppose people inside were all killed, like the Ladici, the Germans. But
In this particular burning down, the thing, there was nobody in the buildings.
Mm-hmm.
They evicted everybody out of the building and burned the whole damn town down. Not a tiny little crossroad, really, but no, nobody was killed. They tried to find who sniped, but they didn't get anywhere. And I guess it's probably when they found they couldn't get anywhere, they evicted everybody and burned the few houses that were around that area now.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. Do you think that the reason something like that was done was perhaps because the kind of people who would be there now would be either zombies or conscription types?
Oh, no.
Who don't know quite how to deal with the situation as would someone who had been there before?
No, I've misled you. This happened right after the war, really before the formal occupation force was formed. It wasn't part of the occupation force. So the other people that came back, these were combat soldiers, just as they have started to don tools. So this is before the
changeover.
The occupation force. During the occupation force, I think the odd person would get rude, and occasionally you get people turning their backs and that sort of stuff. Sure, a few ways you do it by, but there wasn't very much opposition. I remember one or two little towns were uncomfortable to go through, but that's all.
You can find out with any, after any war.
Sure.
Did you enjoy your stay? I mean, we've talked about it in terms of what you did, but did you enjoy the time spent there?
In occupation? Yes, yeah.
We spent a long time, I mean, over a year.
Yeah, but it was we were so busy that it didn't really, it wasn't dull. A lot of the combat troops that were there had a terrible time trying to keep busy. They were just guarding people and that sort of stuff, and they were bored, very bored, and we weren't at all. We were very busy.
Did you ever get the feeling, and this is something Colonel Wilkins rather intimated, that he was doing a lot of administration and not too much hands-on engineering work, and that led to a bit of a frustration on his part. Did you encounter the same thing?
Yeah, that's true. No, it wasn't proper engineering work. It was engineer supervision to a degree, and certainly I did even more administration than he did, because I was his deputy. But with such a relatively small number of Canadians running such a very large number of Germans, administration was the main thing. But there's quite a bit of planning mixed up with it, too. I remember when he came back from a holiday in England, and I had agreed to redecorate the officer's mess, which is some old schloss that somebody had in Oldenburg. And I don't quite know how it got away, but anyway, we put little bulbs all over the ceilings, and flash on and off like stars. He was pretty aggravated.
But he strikes as being a very easygoing person. Was that way as an officer?
Fairly. Yeah, he was a good fellow to work with.
Well, speaking of him, this perhaps leads to something else. He was concerned about doing engineering work, what he had been trained to do, and he rather foresaw a career in the forces as not leading to much work in that vein, in that after achieving a certain rank, you are simply doing administration or staff work or something along those lines.
That's true.
And he was thinking very seriously, and in fact, I think by this point he'd even decided that he wasn't going to remain in the Army, he was going to get out and do support in the civilian field. Were you thinking much the same thoughts, or were you...
Not to the same extent. Both of us, he in particular, really, and he had one more year of it, got into what amounted to heavy engineering construction in the fortification stuff. But even then, we weren't in design. I got into design a year in Ottawa, but even then, as you got more senior, as you say, it becomes a bit more administrative. But he's being a little unfair, because there's quite a bit of engineering planning goes on.
But it's usually true. A set kind, though, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't really expand beyond the boundaries of what is expected for military engineering.
Well, no, but all the construction of all the bases throughout Canada. When I was command engineer in Edmonton, we had everything, not every military, because we didn't have unified services at that stage, but all the Army bases in Alberta and BC and the Northwest Territories and Yukon, including the Northwest Highway System. Now, we didn't directly run the Northwest Highway System, but we ran all the buildings on it, and we were the purveyors of all the funds for the road construction as well, although we didn't have any engineering responsibility. It went directly to Ottawa. And quite a bit, I think what he really was worried about was quite a bit of our work was suballotted to consulting engineers to do the basic design of buildings and roads and airfields or whatever it may be. It's true. As things got bigger, we did less almost, but there was an awful lot of engineering planning. He always wanted to do the physical engineering things, and lots of other people are just as happy doing the administrative side of things, or technical administration, not personal administration. So much. Mm-hmm. And be frank, I preferred the training of people running the engineer school, and we had a very large trade school in Chilliwack, as I'll tell you later. Mm-hmm. But my thoughts were really the people mixed up, as opposed to and my responsibility was not dealing with them. Yes, I knew he was upset. I've had a lot of discussions with him about that. He wanted to do the engineering, and my combat to that is that there are not very many engineers who do design something and build the same thing they designed. Very, very few of them.
Mm-hmm. It was rather amusing. He told me that on his first job, when he was actually doing hands-on work, he got pneumonia.
Yeah.
And after that, he was doing a lot of consulting and not too much actual building.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
so
right.
He was doing much of what he would have been doing in the forces.
That's true. That's true. Well, a lot of consulting engineers do that. I remember when I was briefly with a consulting firm, trying to encourage them to send a bright, bright young engineer off to do the job on the ground that he had just designed, because they needed a bright individual doing it, and B, this kid was probably going to be much better off if he'd found on the ground some of the things he weren't quite practical with putting on the drawing board.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to go too, anyway, but a year later he just quit and went and worked for a municipality where he got whatever he wanted to do, and so they lost this bright young kid. Management of technical people is a tough nut to write, because the vision of designing a bridge and then building it is about 1,000 to 1 against ever happening.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you this, in terms of personality for an engineer, are they in the same category as a creative artist, or is it someone who is like a mathematician, he's aware of the factors and he plays with the factors, as opposed to being creatively artistic?
Unfortunately, most engineers are like the mathematician, they're not like the artist.
That's good, isn't it?
It's good in a way, but it isn't in others. The result of it is that they don't approach people that they're working for in a good way, and that's why architects usually can get ahead of them, because they're the ones with the imagination of what's going to happen,
mm-hmm.
and a totally impractical possibility of which way the bloody door opens.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if you've got an architect to come up with a house or a building or a room or whatever, it's not unusual you can't even get a bed in the bedroom, because they've got too many doors all swinging in, things of this sort. So engineers will take this thing and turn it around and put the doors out or things of this sort. Architects keep forgetting that in a school, for instance, you cannot have any doors opening in a classroom. They all got to open out because of fire.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas engineers, they just know this and they just do it that way. Engineers will occasionally forget that when you do that, you might slam the damn thing open into a running number of people coming down the bloody corridor running the other way. So it's not just as simple as opening all the doors out.
What about sliding doors?
Well, sliding doors are a bit of a problem, but most fire people don't like sliding doors. They want the door to be able to open out and fly and go right back if it's a school.
School, because crushing crowds within the room would make it difficult to open.
Well, yeah. You get pushed up against the thing, you can't slide the door. Basically, you want to be able to put panic hardware so just they both open. But as I say, if there's 10 classrooms coming down this way and they're all running down here and you open a door in their faces, there's a hell of a mess. So it means you inset the door.
Yeah.
So they don't protrude into the corridor. Well, I mean, there's a bit of imagination mixed up in it, but the architects are too airy-fairy in their imagination. When the engineers don't seem to have any airy-fairy imagination at all. You got to get
the natural order of things that should be yours. Because if you had an artistic engineer, you could not have a need anymore for
an
architect.
Well, or conversely, an architect who is practical. Yeah, that's right.
I think they actually really need each other. Because
yes,
most architects designing a large building can't.
You've got to somehow make these things that hang out here stand up. Yeah, no, I agree. They do need each other. There's no doubt about it. But no, the architects are the visionaries, and the engineers are the more practical doers. They
so they
but very often without any imagination at all, which is a bloody shame.
That's a trait you notice, I think.
Yeah.
I should think, and I don't mean this in a pejorative sense, but be more accentuated within the army.
No, it isn't. For some reason or other, within the narrow stage, you find an engineer that's responsible for the decoration of a mess does not resort to going to an architect at all, partly because of expense, and partly because they the general tells you what he wants. It may or may not be tasteful, and you dare tell him it isn't if he is, if it isn't. There are architects in the military engineers, not many, they usually work in the basic design of the standard type things, and so I would say that the military engineer is sometimes more wide in his view of the of how it's going to affect people than the civilian engineer. Well, partly because he's done so many different things. You very seldom do two exactly the same things in a row. If you're a structural engineer, you don't stay a structural engineer at all. You go off to be running a sewer plant the next time you, and then you next time you're teaching in RMC or one of the service colleges, or so your military side has been broadened very considerably just by wearing uniform and having to participate in military things. Whereas a civilian engineer, particularly a consultant engineer, may stay completely in structure with nothing else, never do anything else at all.
So his vision is rather limited.
Well, no, it isn't. It's wider and wider about a narrow subject, but it's more detailed about a narrow subject, I guess. And the subject doesn't broaden. Whereas the military engineer becomes a soldier as well as a military engineer, as an engineer, mm-hmm. and as such. Probably appreciates what the soldiers need, if we're talking about accommodation,